Hello, everyone. This is Brian Murphy, Director of the Association of Clinical Documentation Improvement Specialists. I want to welcome you all to our very first quarterly conference call of 2012. Just for a few housekeeping-type tips before we get started, I want to let you know that today's call is being recorded, and you can listen to this call if you have to hang up early or dialing in late. You can listen to it on our quarterly conference calls page as a digital download. Secondly, as a quarterly conference call, it is kind of a live interactive call. We do encourage your comments and questions throughout, and it's a very simple process to do. You just press *1 on your telephone keypad, and our operator, Jackie, will put your call through at the soonest possible convenience. So again, that's *1 if you have a question. If you have any technical issues, we do ask you press *0 on your telephone keypad, and our bridge company will assist you with that. I want to start off today's call by introducing our four new advisory board members. We have them with us today. Let's see, we have Sue Bealey, who's from 3M. I'm very glad to have Sue on board. Sue adds a lot of expertise. She's got an RHIA and a coding background, a quality background, and she's very involved with electronic health records with 3M. So I want to welcome Sue aboard.
Thank you.
Next up, we have with us Dr. Tim Brundage. Dr. Brundage is an active physician and he is deeply involved with Kindred and medical record review and serves as a physician liaison with the case management departments within that facility. He adds a lot about medical necessity issues. So I'm very glad to have Dr. Tim Brundage aboard with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay. Thanks, Bridge Company, for getting that out of there. next up, we have with us Fran Jurak. Fran, for those that might have seen her name, she is the author of our CCDS exam study guide and has helped us develop our CCDS certification. And I'm glad to have Fran aboard. And our last member is Dee Shad. Oh, hey, Fran. And Dee, I don't know if we have Dee on the line, but she
yes,
is.
Yes, I'm on here, Brian.
Oh, you are, Dee.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dee is an active clinical documentation specialist. She's also has a strong presence in our local chapters and adds a lot of enthusiasm and her own brand of expertise to the board. So welcome aboard, Dee.
Thank you, Brian.
And just for our membership, we had a new process this year where in the past, we used to have our existing advisory board vote on the new members of our board. This year, we changed the process. We had a nominating committee, which consisted of, and I do want to thank these folks very much. They had a lot of, they spent a lot of time with this new process. It was Glenn Krause, Sheila Bullock, and Gary Garrison, who are former board members, as well as Cheryl Erickson, and an at-large ACTUS member, Linda Yildirim. They served as a nominating committee. Their responsibility was evaluating all the applications, conducting phone interviews of all of our top applicants, and then we came up with a final pool that our membership voted on. And I think we had about 500 members vote, so probably a little less than 20%, which is pretty good, I guess, for an election. And that decided our four new board members. So it was a combination, again, of nominating committee and popular vote. I'm very pleased with the way it turned out. I think we have four great representatives on our board, and that's going to be the process moving forward. So thanks again to our members for that. A few other things I want to update you on before we get to questions, and we did receive a number of questions from the members. We're also going to have a short presentation in just a few moments from Glenn Krause on the board. I do want to let everyone know who's listening on the call. If you go to our quarterly conference calls page on the website, Glenn's going to be referencing a few transmittals from various MACs, I think from NGS and Trailblazer. And that's coming up in just a moment. If you want to, you can certainly take a look at those. You're welcome to print them out. It's not necessary, but you might just want to, you can click along and follow Glenn. He's going to be just making a few references to some recent transmittals. But again, before we get to that, just a few other quick things. As we all know, ICD-10 is under the spotlight right now, that the implementation date of October 1st, 2013 is being revisited by CMS. We don't have any new news to share with you, but we're certainly closely following that situation. It's an ongoing issue, I know, with some strong physician lobbies versus hospital lobbies, and we just don't have any new news at this time. We're hoping it's not going to be too far out, but I know there's going to be a new rulemaking period from what I'm hearing, where there'll be some public input and then probably a new deadline issued. So we'll continue to monitor that situation. A few other brief things about our conference. So this is shaping up to be our biggest conference ever. We have our attendance is on pace to be larger than last year. We've got some great sessions to offer. You can view them all on the website. Our poster session is filled. We have a number of presenters that have submitted applications. We're working on our day two local chapter lunch. We're working with the San Diego local chapter to have some fun activities for all you during our day two lunch. As usual, our day one lunch will be a plated lunch, and we'll also be introducing our CDI Professional of the Year at that time. Our nomination period is closed for the CDI Professional of the Year. That closed on February 3rd. We do have a number of excellent applicants. I actually have a call with our conference committee later on today to discuss those applicants, and we will be choosing a CDI Professional of the Year as well as two winners for CDI Professional Achievement. All three of those folks will be recognized at the conference and given an award and have a chance to say a few words. That's one of my favorite parts about the conference every year, is recognizing the good work that people do in this profession. And I hope to see you all there. So at this point, Glenn, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk. Actually, I take that back. I want to mention just one other thing that's going on in the association. For those that haven't been able to visit it yet, we have a new, if you go to our local chapter page on our website, we have a new kind of a fun interactive map we've put up. You can click on the various states and see where our local chapters are and when their next meetings are. It's just kind of a fun website upgrade we were able to add. We have some various new local chapters that have been now in operation, including Vermont, West Virginia, Philadelphia, Dallas, and San Antonio and Austin have their own chapters. So if you're not part of a chapter yet, if you'd like to be a chapter, if you're in a state that does not have a chapter yet, I do encourage you to contact Melissa Varnavis, whose name is all over our local chapter page and her email address, and she'd be willing to certainly get you in touch with some folks to get that process started. But again, our chapter's been very busy. A lot of activity there, and I'm pleased with the way that's coming along with the association. So again, at this point, I want to turn things over briefly to Glenn Krause. Glenn's a longstanding member of our board. Glenn's very passionate about CDI and its relationship to the physician piece, and how he's always encouraging physicians as partners in CDI and not just having it about the hospital benefit. And recently, he's seen a few transmittals from the various MACs that do emphasize this relationship, and he's going to walk us through a few of them today.
All right.
So, Glenn, do you want to take over?
Thank you, Brian. Hey, first of all, if you went to the the link on the website that Brian mentioned, and you click on the first link, it for some reason doesn't go to the page. So if you later on want to type in ngsmedicare.com and enter in the search button, mobile medical review team, you'll come up with this document. But I think it really is important, kind of shapes my thoughts. Is it what it was is Jurisdiction 13, which is in the Connecticut area. The NGS Medicare MAC contractor actually had nurses, they call it mobile because they actually went out to the hospitals and looked at some documentation to decide who has good practices and what is a good practice of documentation. And what caught my attention was the definition that they used. And I just want to read this as a quote. It says, definition of good practice. A good practice is defined as exemplary documentation that clearly identifies the treatment rendered throughout the hospital stay, allowing for an accurate account of the patient's health status. Okay, now if you kind of think about what we're focusing on majority of the time, because this is what CDI programs have been billed as, is a avenue to increase reimbursement and enhance the revenue legitimately, of course, is that we're kind of locked into our situation of really focusing on the clinical diagnosis, principal and secondaries, which is, of course, very important. But the piece that we really are missing out on, I think, is looking at the entire record and saying, how could we improve the documentation to help the hospital and help the physician? In this particular document, it goes on to say, good practice habits were specifically noted throughout, It goes on to say that most facilities utilize electronic documentation were able to demonstrate a timely, consecutive record of physician orders, treatment, and diagnostic reports that were concise. And a couple of key points here is that facilities with proper documentation ensured that each medical record showed that a beneficiary was receiving reasonable and necessary services covered by the Medicare plan by providing detailed documentation, including severity of signs and symptoms, predictability of something adverse happening, a concern for possible complications documented clearly. So as we review records, these are not things that we're necessarily focusing on. We are looking at the signs and symptoms and trying to relate them to possible or provisional and hopefully diagnoses that are ruled in. However, we're not really looking at the entire picture of, does the patient's physician's documentation support the admission to the hospital? And that's something we certainly, we're actually reading that information, but not necessarily impressing upon the physician the value of that to their own business. So I encourage people to read this because it really outlines, I think, obviously what exemplary documentation is, but how can we help the hospital, help the patient, and help the physician all going down the same path for complete documentation. Now, the second link I have in there is about is something from Trailblazers that actually indicates the impact of these DRG reviews that they're doing and the cert contractor and the RAC has upon the physician's business. And basically what it's saying, I think really geared towards surgeons, is that if we find an issue of medical necessity for doing a procedure, particularly with cardiac and now we're talking about joint replacement, not only will the hospital not get paid, neither will the physician. Because many a time physicians, they tell us that basically I'm getting paid, so who cares about the hospital? I'm not saying all, but that's certainly an issue. So this is kind of a wake-up call to them. The other piece I had on here was called Inpatient Claims, Reasons for Denials, and Documentation Tips. And remember, we're in the business of documentation improvement, and certainly reading this opens up some, I think, avenues for what we potentially can be doing moving forward. I'm on the CDI a roadmap committee to come up with a practice brief with several others on the call here regarding what is a CDI program? What are potential best practices? And some of these actually play right into what we're trying to accomplish with that work group. It has actual documentation tips for clinical review for ER staff. Obviously, we're reviewing the ER notes. Documentation tips for physicians. We certainly could share these documentation tips with physicians to help them with their own business. It really helps everyone involved, including explaining the good practices of inpatient account for care. It has documentation tips for nurses. Certainly nurses' documentation plays into good exemplary documentation of patient care, and tips from the medical record department. So this is certainly something that we can take note of. And the last thing that we have here is just was released by Trailblazers also on widespread probe review on DRG 246, which happens to be cardiovascular procedures with drug-eluting stent with MCC documentation. And basically, they reviewed, looks like, 100 records and found, they found, let's see here, almost half the claims, or 42%, or 58% were denied for a variety of reasons. And the top majority of reasons for denial were based really on documentation. It says the documentation submitted didn't support changing the planned elective outpatient status to an inpatient admission, and meaning the patient started as an outpatient and then the doctor wrote an order for inpatient. We often see that where the patient changes the inpatient, then we're tasked with looking at the record and we're scratching our head wondering why the patient's inpatient. The other major cause for denial was the documentation sent to Trailblazers didn't support the medical necessity of the planned inpatient admission. So the severity of signs and symptoms, comorbid conditions, and so forth, and how they impacted medical decision-making of the doctor weren't in the chart. And the last, and if you read this, I encourage you to read all of this. The last, what really caught my attention, though, was this bullet point under strategies to improve documentation, which, of course, we're in the business of improving documentation. It says, hospitals should ensure that physicians and others who provide inpatient services produce clinically meaningful inpatient records. So I just want to throw this out there as a thought or a question. What is clinically meaningful inpatient records? It certainly expands well beyond the horizons of just of picking up CCs or querying for CCs, MCCs, clinical specificity. It really spans the entire spectrum of why was the patient, what was the decision process to that caused the physician to come to the conclusion that this patient needs to be have this procedure, and if it's going to be done in the inpatient, what are the risk factors and so forth. That's something that we review in records. We certainly can impact that. So, Brian, did I meet my 5-minute quota?
You did great, Glenn. I appreciate it.
And the last thing, just a minute here, is that if you read these examples, okay, we certainly or definitely can relate to the first example, which does not equate to the actual necessity for inpatient admission, where the second is much better. It gives us an example of what really belongs in the hospital.
Yep. Well, and I appreciate that, Glenn. That's mm-hmm. That's all great stuff. I wanted maybe to throw that over to Dr. LaCharité or Dr. Brundage. I know you guys are really involved heavily now in some of viewing records from the medical necessity standpoint and making sure all these other this other supporting documentation's in the record, you know, beyond, as Glenn said, just the secondary diagnoses that impact payment. Is it fair to say that your roles have changed quite a bit in response to some of these take-backs and recovery audit contractors?
Absolutely. I cannot tell you how much extra time this has added to my day to try to make sure that our documentation is bulletproof and that our appeal process is aggressive and righteous. So
yep.
It's a lot of extra work.
And I would add that it's very difficult to get physician buy-in, even as a physician. When I call a doctor to ask them about documentation, I'm often met with anger, irritation, and I don't have time for you to call me and talk to me. It's a real issue, and it's an issue that, unfortunately, I have to address at least once a week.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any best practice for that? I mean, I imagine it varies doctor to doctor, but I don't know if you have any standard advice you would give to maybe our members about how to help break down that barrier at all.
I guess I would say don't give up.
Well, if I can add something, Brian, to that.
Sure.
I've been reading the Federal Register piece on the Value Modifier Program for physicians, which takes hold in 2015, but fully operational in 2017, and it's very clear that the Medicare intends to use the physician's claims data, i.e., who ordered what, and how many times I saw the patient, if I'm an inpatient or if I'm in primary care, what test do they order, as a measure of how efficient are they at providing the same, treating the same diagnosis as their counterparts in the same specialty. And certainly, as a physician, if I'm going to be potentially losing 5% of my E&M levels for all Medicare patients beginning in 2015 because I'm not very, I'm allegedly not efficient at, let's say, treating a CHF patient compared to my peers, I certainly wouldn't want to send in my baseline data to be inaccurate because I don't have time to effectively order or document in the record. So I'm really letting physicians know you don't go to take your boards or for a physician without practicing. Why would you do the same with your own financial destiny?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot for that topic, Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, we did receive a number of pre-submitted questions from our members, and I'm going to get to as many of those as we can. I do have one member with a question or a comment, Mary Berry, I believe. So could you please put Mary through for us, Jackie?
Mary, you may ask your question.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Good. I'm here with a case manager, one of my supervisors, and a lead coder. As we spoke earlier last week, we're running into medical necessity issues like everybody because of documentation, mm-hmm. lack thereof documentation. Yeah. And I'm wondering if there's any tools out there or where do we begin to find exactly what needs to be in the, I would say, progress notes to follow the patient. Or is other facilities having a problem with this medical necessity at this point?
Are you mentioning medical necessity in terms of the inpatient admission? Is
yes.
it the physician side or what?
Admission and observation.
Right. Well, I certainly, from the standpoint of the physician's own business, which we were relying on for both his business and our business, really the progress note should be complete. As I mentioned, good practice as that document. I think that would be an excellent starting point. But the other thing is that I really impress upon the physicians the need for their own business to have each note stand on its own. So if you look at the requirements of an evaluation management code as a standard of documentation, it basically says each note has to have a chief complaint, a updated or interval history of present illness, a physical exam, an assessment and plan. Now, oftentimes, physicians, what they do is in their plan, they say, "See orders." Do you see, or just write the diagnosis, same diagnosis of pneumonia, 4 days in a row. When the patient came in with an unstable condition, and obviously they're slowly improving, otherwise the doctor would likely discharge the patient. So what is the status of the patient every day the doctor sees the patient? Is the pneumonia improving? Is the white count trending down? Is the patient not responding to therapy? And if you look at what the doctor needs for his own documentation for subsequent E&M levels, there's three levels. The highest level is a patient who's unstable, who's developed who developed a new problem or major complication. A level two would be a patient who's responding slow to therapy, who's developed a minor complication. And so if you look at what the doctor needs, in terms of his business, even if the doctor is employed or in the hospital is employed, that's the kind of documentation we need to demonstrate medical necessity. What's wrong with the patient? Why is the patient still there? What's the history of the present illness updated? And what if it's a pneumonia, obviously we're looking at the chest. If it's a heart failure, we're looking at the heart, maybe looking at the legs. What is the status of the patient when I examine them? And after I do all that, what's my assessment and plan? And it can't be cut and paste. It can't be the same note every day because it's not showing that the doctor's making any medical decision making.
Glenn, this is Lynn. I would just add for Mary, another great resource that you could use, Mary, that you might find very helpful is the Pepper Resources webpage. This is developed by the Texas Medical Foundation that generate the PEPR reports. So if you go to pepperresources.org, and at the top of the page, there's a link for tools. You'll find a sheet, a page that says PEPR tools, and there are worksheets that you can look at or checklists that are divided into two categories. The first one is medical necessity, and the second one is coding. So under the medical necessity checklist, for example, you can find tools for one-day stay audit, one-day inpatient stay audit tool, short stay admission case management protocol, admission per case management protocol, and then on the DRG side, you find some DRG validation tools for not all of the DRGs, but typically these are the ones, of course, that are being audited. Things like chest pain, syncope, dehydration, abdominal pain, DRG 391, 92, sepsis, et cetera. They have a specific tool, audit tool for septicemia, a DRG MCC CC tool, a DRG validation worksheet, excisional debridement guidelines. So I think some of these are very helpful because what you can do is look at these worksheets and see on this audit tool, what are they looking for in the record? And I think from a CDI standpoint, it kind of lets you know, well, if auditors are going to look to see if this is there, then maybe I should make sure that it is there in the documentation. I find this a very helpful resource.
Well, that's a good point, Lynn.
Thank you.
Okay.
I guess one of the only other questions I may have is a patient comes in and meets the interqual criteria for an admission. And Rita, do you want to take
yes.
over? This is Rita, the case
Hi.
Manager.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the difficulty that we're having is that the patient may come in the door and truly meet the critical level of severity of illness, intensity of services for a specific criteria set, and they meet inpatient criteria hands down. So we're looking at that patient as, yes, they've met the level of care to be in the hospital. And, you know, through treatment, or, you know, from the physician, they may improve well enough to go home in less than 48 hours. But they did meet that intense level coming in the door. So now we're getting the comments of, well, it should have been observation coming in the door because they got better and left.
My experience thus far has been while the CMS MedLearn Matters transmittal was, if nothing else, intentionally vague on OBS versus inpatient, we have found that if we can demonstrate that they met interqual or Milliman or preferably both, then we win the appeal, hands down. It seems to be taken as law by both our RAC and all the private insurers. So,
well, then again, it comes back to physician documentation.
Absolutely.
If everything is there and it meets, then we win. If it doesn't and it didn't, then we lose. So.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
One thing I want to add is that I just read something last night on the WPS Medicare website. They have a draft, and it's geared towards physicians. It's not geared towards hospitals. It's a draft LCD on inpatient versus observation, and it's to be finalized by the end of March, I believe, but I encourage you to read it because it's written by physicians, geared towards physicians about what is their responsibility of documentation to justify either one.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe, Glenn, you can send me that after
the
program today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to try to get to some of our...
I'd like to have that website as well.
Yeah,
we can get that, Brian.
Okay. I will get that out to everybody. I'll get it posted on the conference calls page, too. Happy to do so. All right, I want to get to a couple of questions because these were submitted by members, and so we'll these are on some various different topics related to CDI, but the first one reads, you know, could I ask that we discuss in the next quarterly call the use of checkboxes on documentation queries posted in medical records. I've seen a few blog responses to how to query for, with responses including use of checkboxes for physicians to respond. So I don't know if I maybe put that out to the board. Does anyone like to talk about this, just in general, about the use of checkboxes, pros and cons?
Hey, Brian, this is Dee. I'll be glad to give my comments on it.
Okay.
Although it is permissible because it's documented in the AHIMA practice brief on queries, I'm not so sure that I would put it under best practice, since our goal is to improve the actual documentation into the records. And I think if we kind of train the physicians to use checkboxes, that's not really getting them into the habit that we want them, and that's to include the documentation in the record. What I do think that it is good for is to maybe get the further specificity on a diagnosis that they've already documented, like the CHF, you know, just to clarify acute, chronic, systolic, diastolic. That's a little more acceptable from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Dee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if we have Dr. Kennedy on. He had sent a few
responses. I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Kennedy here. I would like to support what Dee said. Checkboxes are permissible according to the guidelines, or at least not the guidelines, but the AHIMA practice brief of 2008. The challenge is ascertaining the authenticity of the checkbox. You know, did the physician, him or herself, actually make the check? To what extent it's relatively simple, asking a simple question. However, the more complex the query, the harder checkboxes are, and they're just hard to do.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the input, everyone. This next question was, and this is, I certainly would welcome our members to chime in if they would like to use star one and certainly submit their own best practice or opinion. But the question reads, I'd like to hear how other facilities handle queries after discharge and before the case has been final billed. Do they have a policy on this they'd be willing to talk about? I know some folks have really developed policies, others maybe not. But again, I'll throw that out to the board. Any general discussion on the issue of queries, again, after discharge but before final billing?
Could you read that question again, Brian?
Sure. It just says, I'd like to hear how other facilities handle queries after discharge and before the case has been final billed. You know, do they have a policy on this they'd be willing to talk about?
Well, I know here at several of my colleagues' facilities, their policy is to obviously affect the documentation improvement and after the patient obviously is discharged. The trouble with that, even if you have an effective policy, is that you get the diagnosis clarified after, whether it's an amendment to the record with a progress note dated the date the doctor actually amended the record, or have a query that's a permanent part of the medical record, is oftentimes the rationale for that. Rationale of how the doctor came up with that diagnosis is called into question. We've had several insurance companies review the record post-discharge as part of their contract to allow to steal back money, and these are not necessarily Medicare, and said, well, the doctor was asked it, but the rationale and the medical decision-making, we don't see how the doctor came up with that diagnosis, therefore we're going to disallow it. So that's, I think, one of the dangers, is that we ask him for a clarification. It's signed and dated, and the question is there, or the doctor makes a notation, oftentimes just writes aspiration pneumonia present on admission, clarifying pneumonia, but the rationale of where that diagnosis came from, whether the patient had risk factors of alcoholic or esophageal stricture or some other entity, whether it's Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or whatever, is not in the record, and they think that's kind of leading.
Okay.
Brian, this is Gail.
Hey,
and one of the things that happens here is how to handle queries. If we're talking about a query that a CDI has left while the patient was there on the floor and the patient was discharged and the physician didn't address it, it also has variables whether there's a discharge summary actually done yet or not. But what happens is if it's a CDI query, it goes back to the CDI that wrote it or the CDI office to take a look at it and see, reevaluate it, reassess it, and see whether it is something that still needs to be followed through for clarification or not. Most of these aren't the introduction of a new diagnosis, but they're the clarification of something that was in the record to begin with. That's the reason we put the queries in there. So it's followed up by the CDI who authored it. Our office. If it is something that the coder is looking at and is having difficulty because it's conflicting documentation or something that's really not clear, it still comes in as a validation process into the CDI office. And if we openly support with them, if they would like to query, we can help with that query clinically. If they would like us to follow through, you know, and contact the doctor and get that clarified, then we also do that. So we handle a query process post-discharge just as if it was concurrently. We work together as a team on that, and if it's an open one, I guess to summarize, from CDI, we try to handle it back again with our office.
Brian, this is Lena. This is the same process that Gail just mentioned is how we handle those as well. Our CDI program, though, handles all of our coder post-discharge queries. So what the coders would do is they would pend the account in our clinical abstracting system, and then our staff would then review that medical record and then follow up with the physicians as appropriate. Some things that the coders may be asking might be things that there isn't enough clinical basis to query for. So those are times when we follow back up with the coding staff to let them know that at that point in time, based on what's going on with that patient, that query wouldn't be appropriate to do. So we kind of triage that before we send it back out to the physicians to make sure, as Glenn was mentioning, you definitely don't want to introduce new diagnoses just out of the blue at the end of the case. So you want to make sure that there is information. And as Gail mentioned, we make sure that that information is throughout, and we're not trying to lead the physicians to document something that wasn't documented anywhere else in the record.
Yeah, I agree. I know, Dr. Kennedy, you mentioned in one of your responses earlier that it could be an issue with uncertain diagnoses at this point in the record. And I don't know if you have any input on that at all.
This is Dr. Kennedy. Query is an essential function of coding. In fact, all the coders queried even before concurrent review became more popular. And certainly there does need certainly the time to clarify inconsistent, incomplete, imprecise documentation is prior to the bill being dropped. Mm-hmm. And certainly the cooperation between concurrent reviewers, coding, and such, as mentioned before, is critical. Where it becomes dicey in our world is what do you do after the bill has been dropped? You know, not uncommonly, coding occurs without a discharge summary. And then the discharge summary comes in, introduces new information that is not congruent with the assigned DRG. And is there a process in place to look at these discharge summaries and reconcile what the discharge summary says as opposed to the assigned DRG? I see that as a challenge. Furthermore, what do we do with after 30 days if there's a potential DRG change, either result of new information that could come in like from a TB culture or a missed procedure or such, or even the results of an audit. These should be very well outlined in policies and procedures that have been crafted with the coding department, with the concurrent reviewers and such. So that way, at least we're all walking as much in a straight line as possible. Thank you for allowing me to share.
All right. I think we might have a comment on this from Sandy Beatty. I know our old friend Sandy Beatty. Do you want to put her through for us?
Ms. Beatty is now on the line.
Hey, Sandy.
Hey, Brian. I was just going to say that we do the same thing with our queries here. At one time, before RAC started, we would code charts before we had the discharge summary. We don't do that anymore. All queries are pre-bill. What we did is change the rules and regs about how much time the physician has to get the discharge summary done, since we're going to wait on it. So they have 7 days to do it. At 7 days, they're deficient. At 14 days, they're suspended, period. Basically, we have a set of criteria that we use. If it's a concurrent query, the assumption is that there's something in the record that is causing you to write a query. And if at discharge there is no response, we then have a set of criteria based on severity of illness changes, on whether or not it's a POA issue, or whether or not it meets a reimbursement threshold for the organization, whether or not we pursue it as a retro query. All the CDIs do the retro queries here at Columbus Regional. If it's a chart that we never reviewed, which is rare because we do all payers, then the coders will go ahead and write their own query. But because we have such a close working relationship with them, they oftentimes will call and ask for our advice, and we help them out. But that's how we handle it.
Thanks a lot, Sandy. I appreciate that input. Okay, I'm going to go back to another pre-submitted question. This is relating to a coding clinic reference and on BMI and dietitian notes. So the question reads, in what context would a CDI nurse or coder find this documentation and be able to use it to formulate a query for the documentation of obesity? So the references to the 2010 second quarter coding clinic. It says coders and CDI personnel are using it to look for dietitian notes stating the BMI. And the coding clinic question is, you know, there's been some confusion as to whether nursing staff documentation is acceptable for assigning the body mass index, since hospitals are allowed to code the BMI based on the dietitian's documentation. It would seem reasonable to assign the BMI based on the nurse's documentation as well. So I guess maybe someone would like to take this one. It's, you know, in what context would a clinical documentation specialist find this documentation and be able to use it to formulate a query for an obesity diagnosis?
Brian, this is Dee. I can give you some insight into what we do at our facility.
Okay.
And with the BMI, we kind of see that we have to have three criteria met there, and that is the BMI, and we do take it from clinicians, either the nurses, the dietitians, but then we look for the associated diagnosis from the physician documented. But the other piece, for it to meet the definition of a secondary diagnosis, there has to be, you know, clinical evaluation, diagnostics, therapeutic treatment, or increased nursing care or length of stay. So that's the piece that we also address. A lot of times people will just say, it, you know, of course it takes more, but we want to have it documented to support that we're using it for a secondary diagnosis. So we actually also query the nursing staff to see if there was extra care involved in that patient, such as more than one person to assist in transfers, in ambulation. Did we need to order bariatric equipment for that patient? So we try to look at all three pieces of that diagnosis.
What about the thought process of a morbidly obese patient, where people might say that, you know, there's just going to be a lot more
But, you know, you'd be surprised because when we actually ask some of the nurses about, you know, some of those BMI patients, they're like, oh, no, that person is very ambulatory. We didn't have to do a thing for them. So.
Okay.
This is Cheryl. Actually, there's been a coding clinic that came out third quarter 2011. That's probably a good reference for everybody, and it's talking about obesity, if the provider documents obesity or morbid obesity in the history and physical or the discharge summary without any additional documentation, can it be coded? And the answer was individuals who are overweight, obese, or morbidly obese are at an increased risk for certain medical conditions when compared to persons of normal weight. Therefore, these conditions are always clinically significant and reportable when documented by the provider. So I think that's a big win.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because we were getting denials from our Blue Cross Blue Shield payers saying that we had to have how the obesity impacted the case. And so it's nice to see that Coding Clinic is treating it like a chronic condition, and they've already said in the past that some chronic conditions are always going to be of significance whenever they're present.
What was that, Cheryl, that reference from Coding Clinic? Do you
have it? Third quarter 2011, pages 3-4.
Okay.
Right, and this is Donna. We actually submitted that question from the state of South Carolina because we had been receiving multiple denials from other payers on that. And we were glad to see this because this will help support some of those denials.
Oh, that was your question you guys submitted, Donna. That's great.
Yeah.
There's democracy in action right there.
Brian, this is Gail. And the only other thing that we do is sometimes it's really funny. You'll see a physician write down obesity, and if you look at the BMI is 36. Or it's not morbid obesity.
Yep.
And so we do, I direct my staff always to if you have an obese patient and it's written down there and you're looking at it as a secondary, to just check with the nursing staff, because we just want to make sure that what the calculation is that's in there is correct.
Okay. All right, I'm showing I have another caller on the line, so maybe we could put them through. This is Mohammed Ahmed, if I have that last name right.
Yeah. This is Mohammed Ahmed. Do you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, Brian.
Hello.
My question is, what is the role of CDI in observation unit? You know, the observation unit is usually 8 hours to 23 hours. Does CDI, you know, impact on the observation unit?
Mm-hmm. Any comments from the board on that? I know that's probably a little bit of a non-traditional role, but we had on our last call, we had a representative on who's they're looking at more of emergency department, but some observation as well.
This is Cheryl.
Hey, Cheryl.
People get confused about observation level of care, and if you read the regulations, observation level of care actually requires more documentation than inpatient care, not less, because it has to show that there's ongoing evaluation and services being provided in order to make the determination whether the patient needs subsequent care or can be discharged. So I think there is some opportunity for CDI in that observation setting. I would say probably the primary place where CDI could be involved is the place where most organizations are vulnerable is following any kind of procedure and then putting a patient in observation. If someone's having a procedure, they've already had an episode of care, and there has to be something either they fail the procedure or they fail the recovery. And I'm using the term fail loosely, so maybe they have continued nausea, vomiting, maybe something goes wrong during the procedure, maybe they have uncontrolled pain. But there has to be that documentation to show that they're requiring an additional episode of care following that procedure in order to justify that observation. And that's where a lot of vulnerability exists, is a lot of times patients are just kept overnight because that's what they've always done, or it's kept for monitoring, and that's not going to support an observation charge.
All right.
Thank you.
Hope that answered your question. Thanks, Cheryl. I don't know if you had any other comments from the board. I did want to get to this next question. I did promise the person I would ask it. It's kind of a big question, and I'm sure it varies from hospital to hospital, but it reads, we have just started a new CDI program in our hospital. Congratulations, by the way. And would like input as to the best way to allocate assignments, i.e. by floor, unit, service, and they're a level one teaching hospital by way of background. If you have any experience and input, it would be much appreciated. They're very excited about their new program! Exclamation point. So, does anybody have Gail, Cheryl, or Lynn, or anybody who else who's, you know, managed overseeing a program? Do you have any best practice on that? How to allocate those assignments out? I know some people say you'd like the staff to be cross-trained, and others say that you should really focus them in so they can, you know, really learn a type of patient mix, or I don't know what the thoughts are here.
Well, this is Lynn. Initially, for a brand new person, I would start them out on a unit where they felt comfortable with their level of clinical expertise. So if they're coming from critical care, I would assign them to critical care units. If they had a lot of experience in cardiology, I would start them out in cardiology, because initially it's really hard to incorporate not only the clinical pathology but all these CDI concepts. Everything is new. So I tried to make it a little easier by letting them go somewhere where they knew the drugs, they knew the doctors or whatever. But then after that, I would rotate a new person through each unit in the hospital and usually have them spend, you know, at least a month there. So for a brand new CDS, they're not going to be able to handle a full assignment in the beginning anyway. But assuming, you know, they've been there 6 months and they are starting to have a feel for what their role is, again, I would give them an assignment and let them keep that assignment for 3 months. But I would rotate my team routinely, like every 3 months. It sort of helps you from becoming stale. It lets you develop expertise in other clinical areas. And if you do that, then your team really is prepared to review records on any unit in the hospital. You know, they're not struggling to think about, well, what would be associated diagnosis for this case? I have no idea about neurology. So that's my feeling.
Hi, Brian. It's Gail. Actually, a new program. The first thing that I like to do with new CDIs is to buddy up. Absolutely, their expertise and where they feel comfortable is the best place to start. Just like Lynn said, to know the drugs, to know the testing, to have that as a secondary, you know, innate response is awesome, because they can maneuver through the book in their head and figuring out where they are. And to buddy up and to be able to have somebody else there, not to feel alone, and to be able to talk out a diagnosis or not get caught up in something and learn how somebody else is doing it with them, I think is important. We also cover each other for sick calls. So there's rotation, but there's also, we do flip those assignments so that they get other areas that they cover and give us insights back to where we are. The last thing that I really do take a look at is some floors are very heavy with turnover and the number of queries that might come out of that, maybe a telemetry unit versus an oncology floor. You know, the telemetry unit might have a lot of short-term stays, chest pain, syncope, and so therefore it takes a longer amount of time to go, even though they're short charts, to go through them and make sure you have criteria and everything in place, that that chart needs to be clean and accurate and have a good amount of integrity. So that turnover and query amount is something to consider when you've got a new program and you're divvying out the floors.
I think another thing to consider is the interaction between the CDS and the doctor. I think there's a big benefit with consistency of having the same CDS interact with the same doctor or group of doctors day after day after day. You build that trust and that relationship, and I think that goes a long way to producing results.
Yep.
I agree with that comment. This is Cheryl, and I'm at an academic medical center, and I would recommend that you staff by service, because you do have to develop that relationship. We find that our attendings are on every 3 months, and so if we're changing our CDIs too frequently, then the attendings are going to get very confused, because it's not going to be the same person that's going to be on the next time they're on service. The other issue that you have with a teaching hospital is the residents, and depending on how quickly your residents change. In some of our services, they change every week, and in other services, they change every 4 weeks. So really, you'd want to focus on a service rather than on a unit, because that way you're able to develop those relationships. The other thing that I would suggest to you, too, is hit the medical side a lot harder initially than the surgical side. At least in our academic medical center, we have a really hard time hitting the surgeons, because their workflow is such that their rounding is very expedited. It's pretty much just checking wounds and things like that. And we do better working with their PAs and the nurse practitioners. And so if you want to be involved with the medical staff, you might want to start while you're launching your program, developing credibility, work on the medical side where they're a little more accessible than the surgical side. But if you'd like to contact me offline, I'm happy to share anything from being at an academic medical center.
Thanks, Cheryl. And for those listening, though, not so that Cheryl gets flooded with emails, but her email address is on the advisory board page.
Brian, I could serve as a resource as well. This is Lena Wilson with IU Health.
Oh, thanks, Lena.
Academic Medical Center, Level 1 Trauma, definitely have a lot of experiences working the gamut. So if anyone would like to contact me, I'd be more than willing to help.
Okay, great. We do have a couple other members with questions, so why don't we go to Alice Palermino. Alice, your line is, I believe, is live. Is that correct, Jackie?
Yes. Hi. Okay. Our question is it recommended to have concurrent queries as a permanent part of the medical record? Right now, our retro queries are, and our concurrent queries are not. And if so, what are other hospitals doing?
Any thoughts on that from the board? By concurrent queries, do you mean just straight verbal queries or actually queries you're getting clarified on paper? Or I'm not entirely sure what you mean by that.
They're written and verbal.
Okay.
This is Lena with IU Health. Our queries are not a part of the legal permanent medical record. They are able to be viewed by the physicians and pretty much by anyone in that medical record, but when we do release those out, that was the advice that we received from our legal department. So they are viewable, they're just not released. So we ask the physicians to then respond in, you know, either updating an addendum to one of their previous progress notes, the current day's note, or the discharge summary, whatever's most convenient for them.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Alice. Any other comments from the board on that? I know that's a subject of ongoing debate, whether you should be retaining these as part of the permanent record or not.
This is Cheryl. I would just be a little concerned of the inconsistency between keeping retrospective queries and not keeping concurrent queries. And so I would just be a little concerned, and I hate to put Donna on the spot, but I know she's really strong in the regulations and things and does a lot with the RAC audits and things.
Yeah.
I think that might be concerning to have a different process for querying retrospective than concurrently.
Right, don't do one versus the other. And, yeah, thanks, Cheryl. This is Donna. The other piece is that, you know, when we're looking at records, we do a lot of post-bill audits. I mean, we go way back. We have claims right now that we're looking at from 2003, 2004 that are under Department of Justice review. And, you know, there's times when, and that was even before we were really vamped up into some of the best practice CDI programs, but, you know, I'll pick up a progress note and there'll be one word that'll say aspiration pneumonia. Now, where did that come from? You know, that's the kind of thing that it's hard to stand on if you don't have a query to kind of show where your thought process is going or the question that you ask the physician. So I have to agree with Cheryl. Keep the queries on there so that we understand the story and what you're asking.
Yeah, Dan and Cheryl, this is Lynn. I think because we all know now that the level of scrutiny for our medical records is intense, and it could either be for a period of time like the RAC where they can only go back 36 months. But as Donna stated, when your facility is having records investigated by another entity, if you're the subject of a Department of Justice investigation, those time frames are not the same. So I think right now CDI programs should make every effort to revisit their policies and procedures and make their query process as transparent as possible. You know, have one policy for everyone. Have your query process be the same before discharge and after discharge. I think that just strengthens the perception of your compliance in your organization.
Right. Thank you, Lynn.
Great. Thanks for all the input on that, guys. Showing the top of the hour, I think we have Diane Johnston in the queue, so maybe we could have Diane ask her question, and then we'll kind of wrap things up here.
information. I don't want to go on this. If you could just send me or where I could find the regulations for our physicians and also for the coding component, if I can have that information. And all the, my second question is I received a RAC request for records. And they're also requesting the physician's query. Has anyone have any comments? Or right now, you know, the query responses is kept outside of, it's not part of the medical record as it was mentioned earlier. Has anyone else received any requests for the queries?
This is Lynn. I would just like to say that all four of the RAC contractors in all four regions, as part of their additional documentation request letter, it does list physician query on all four of those. And facilities are choosing to interpret that in a variety of ways. Of course, if your if any queries are a permanent part of the record, then they must be sent with the record. You can't choose not to send something that is a permanent part of the record. You have to send the complete record. Other facilities are looking at their procedures, and if their queries are not a permanent part of the record, some are choosing not to send them. Other facilities where queries are not a permanent part of the record are sending them if they feel it strengthens their appeal on a case. So, again, this is another reason to look at your process and determine that probably the best way to go is to make your queries a permanent part of the record because, as others have stated, it explains why certain diagnoses are entered into the record, how they may suddenly show up, you know, a few days after the admission and so forth. So, again, it's a transparent process. But right now I'm unaware of any legislation that mandates that they always have to be sent. On a CMS RAC 101 call a little while ago, a caller specifically asked about sending physician queries, and the CMS representative addressed her response in sort of a way that she avoided being specific. What she said on the call was, I would think you would want to send anything that would support the record. So she wasn't, again, stating that you must send it. But again, she was saying, you know, when it comes to the RACs looking at your record, all you have to stand, all that record can stand upon is what is actually there. Once that record has been requested by the RAC, you can't query at this point. You have to sort of consider that record sealed. Nothing can be added. Nothing could be taken away. So this is something that you all have to think about what your process is and determine what would be best for your facility.
Right, thank you very much.
Okay. And if you want to email me after the program, ma'am, because I know you were asking for a reference. I didn't quite get what that was, but you can certainly email me after the program.
Okay, Brian, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Diane. So that does take us to the end of our conference call. We did get to, there were some questions that we did receive that we weren't able to get to. There were a couple of really interesting DRG-related questions, and our board has been emailing back and forth with some of these, and I will get those responses out, and hopefully we'll be able to answer those questions that we couldn't get to live. But I do want to thank everyone who dialed in today and who pre-submitted their questions. Again, the recording of this call will be posted on the ACTS website on our quarterly conference calls page, as all of our calls are, so you can go back and listen to them if you wanted to, weren't able to take notes, or you wanted to go back and listen, had to hang up early. Those are all posted there. And again, I want to thank all of our board members for being on today and sharing their expertise. So at this time, ladies and gentlemen, you can disconnect.